Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his latest book, Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College, today's guest, Jesse Wegman, asks a question many of us have been asking for years. How can we tolerate the Electoral College when every vote does not count the same and the candidate who gets the most votes can lose? Twice in the last five elections, the Electoral College has overridden the popular vote. In 2000 with Al Gore, and in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. In 2016, fewer than 78,000 votes in three states in the upper Midwest counted for more than 3 million votes nationwide. According to Making Every Vote Count, that's a nonprofit dedicated to electing the president by a popular vote, 100 million votes do not count because of the Electoral College. In his book, Jesse Wegman writes about the history of the Electoral College, which began in a negotiation that protected the interests of slave-holding states. He also writes about the 800 or so unsuccessful attempts to amend or abolish the college altogether and the current campaign to push states to give their electors to the person who gets the most votes. Jesse Wegman is a member of the New York Times editorial board, where he has written about the Supreme Court and legal affairs since 2013. In one of his latest pieces called The Republican Party is Attacking Democracy, he writes, in the face of a commanding national triumph by President-elect Joe Biden, Trump and top Republicans are behaving like spoiled children refusing to let go of their toys. And he does not mince words here. He writes, the most dangerous attackers of American democracy are not the Russians or the Chinese. They are the leaders of the Republican Party. Hi, Jesse. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And I want to talk about this op-ed that you wrote before we dive in and talk about your book, because I think it's so important. Reuters just came out with a new poll. They found that half of Republicans believe Trump, quote, rightfully won the election, but that it was stolen from him by widespread voter fraud that favored Joe Biden. I mean, half of Republicans, I'm still waiting to find out how many people they actually spoke to, but this is really dangerous. Can you talk about this?
I mean, sure. We're watching, you know, the creation of a generational myth happen in real time. Donald Trump, his top allies, top Republicans in Congress and around the country, right wing media personalities all kind of bang this drum of voter fraud, voter irregularities, you know, all these things that there's just literally no basis in fact for any of them. You know, when they are called to present their facts in court, they lose almost. I think they are now 1 in 25 in 26 different court proceedings. So they are being thrown out almost summarily by judges who are saying, you know, where's your evidence that anything went wrong in this election? And they have none. They admit it to the judge. But, you know, everybody's playing this. It's as one of my colleagues, Jamel Bowie, said, it's performance art. That's being led by the president of the United States. And the problem is, how many people lower down, how many Republicans all over the country don't realize that it's performance art and are going to be really upset when Joe Biden is sworn in as president on January 20th.
Right, exactly. And on this show, Jesse, we've spent years doing shows about gerrymandering, about voter suppression. And, you know, Ari Berman with Mother Jones has been on so many times. He's written a book about this. And given that you are on the editorial board of The New York Times, I just wonder what your assessment of media coverage of voter fraud, so-called voter fraud, it's been repeated so much this year, and voter suppression has been. Just let's say over the last 5 years, it's definitely gotten better this year, but there's still so much work to do.
I mean, you know, as long as I've been on the editorial board, which is for the past 7.5 years, this has been a kind of abiding fixation of conservative lawmakers all over the country, what they call voter fraud. There is virtually never any evidence of voter fraud anywhere, let alone the sort of widespread systemic incidence of it that would be required in order to reverse the results in even a municipal election, right? It happens periodically. The most recent Example I can think of was actually Republican voter fraud, which happened in the 9th congressional district in North Carolina. And that was based in absentee balloting fraud, which is a slightly easier fraud to pull off than, say, impersonation fraud. That's the kind that they target with these voter ID laws, you know, people going to the polls and pretending to be someone else. It's just completely flies in the face of basic human incentives, right? To assume that people are going to risk going to prison for just by casting a vote illegally, that will have virtually no effect on the outcome of an election. You would need to do this at scale to even hope to have an influence on the outcome of a large scale of a national election. And it just doesn't even happen at a small level. So it's been frustrating to feel like people who push this really phony narrative are getting equal time in the mainstream media. And, you know, I don't excuse my own newspaper from doing that. But I do think we've gotten better in the last several years, especially as their claims have just fallen apart one after the next. They never amount to anything. It's really just, bogus fear-mongering. And I think the more that we can sort of say these are flat earthers on one side and these are basically rational, science-based, fact-based people on the other, we can stop treating them as equal.
So true. And it's also been incredible to see Republican members who are basically who've been at the state level doing such important work around election time, and to see Republicans come out and say they have no evidence. There's nothing there. All of these lawsuits are going nowhere. I mean, I think that people are really learning about the ins and outs of how an election is run like never before because of all of this.
Well, not only do they have no evidence, but as Brad Raffensperger, who's the top elections official in Georgia, said, and a Republican himself said, something we've all been saying all year long, which is Donald Trump himself suppressed the vote in Georgia by, you know, freaking out, especially elderly Republican voters from casting from using vote by mail. Right. Because he was saying all year it's a fraud. It's going to be unfair. It's going to be rigged. Of course, it wasn't. Of course, everyone everywhere has said we ran one of the best, most, cleanest, most corruption-free elections in American history. And we all knew that was going to be the case. But in the meantime, Donald Trump scared off so many of his voters. Brad Raffensperger predicted that had he not done that, he might well have pulled out a victory in Georgia by maybe 10,000 votes. So, you know, it's not simply that they have no evidence for the fraud that they're claiming happened, but that they're in fact suppressing their own voters with these, scare stories. It's really frustrating, and it's really, I really do credit elections officials and poll workers of both parties all over the country who really are kind of the front lines of protecting our democracy in the electoral context. They are the ones who treat this seriously, who take it seriously, and who aren't, running around peddling myths. You know, there are exceptions like we saw yesterday in Wayne County in Michigan, where the Republican members of the Board of Canvassers basically refused to certify Wayne County's vote for patently illegitimate reasons. Those are the exceptions. I think most elections officials in most places in the country really are good, decent, honest people with integrity who care about reporting the results accurately.
Exactly. And they have been working tirelessly overnight in some cases and really putting their lives on the line because of COVID. And we know that some election officials have gotten COVID.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and obviously in the past, elections workers have tended to skew older, right? These are people who are often retired, so they may have more time to staff a polling station. This year, that was a much bigger risk to take, right? You're exposing, even in a good year, right? You're exposing yourself to thousands of your neighbors, and it's flu season, even in a normal year. So people are exposing themselves to danger even then. And this year, of course, they're exposing themselves themselves to exponentially more danger with coronavirus. So, I mean, all the people who helped out, from elderly poll workers to younger people who stepped in and took their places and took some of the burden off of them, I really think they deserve the credit, and they deserve a real thank you from Americans and from defenders of democracy the world over for making this election as smooth as it was under the circumstances.
Jesse, since you brought up Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, I want to ask you about the reporting that's coming out about Lindsey Graham. Stephanie Saul, a reporter with the New York Times, has a piece about this yesterday. And Stephanie reports, on Friday, Lindsey Graham phoned Brad Raffensperger and a fellow Republican wondering about the possibility of a slight tinkering with the state's elections outcome. What if, Mr. Graham suggested on the call, according to Mr. Raffensperger, he had the power to toss out all of the mail-in votes from counties with high rates of questionable signatures on ballots. In an interview with the Washington Post, Raffensperger said he was stunned that Lindsey Graham had appeared to suggest that he find a way to toss legally cast ballots. What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I don't know what there is to say anymore. You know, top Republicans have told us again and again exactly who they are. I am long past worrying about policy disputes between Democrats and Republicans. I obviously, as you can guess, I lean progressive on most issues. But, I would be happy to have those debates again. What we're debating now is not policy disputes. What we're debating now is just the basic protection of democracy, of majority rule, and of the fundamental structures of representative government. Republicans right now are not, by and large, top Republicans are by and large not defenders of that. They are attackers of it. That's why I wrote that piece. And I think we see it every single day exemplified across the country. Lindsey Graham's efforts to literally rig the vote in Georgia are only one of the more egregious examples. And coming from the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think it's only more terrifying. But, you know, from Donald Trump on down, this is a party that has made itself that is at peace with minority rule, right? It is a party that is fundamentally unpopular. Yes, they won. Donald Trump won, I think, in the order of 74, 75 million votes. That's a lot of votes, right? And Republicans looked to hold their Senate. Slim Senate majority would and also pick up some seats in the House. But at every level of government, that Republican power is representative of a minority of Americans, right? More Americans have chosen, more Americans voted for the Democratic senators than for their Republican counterparts. More Americans voted for the members of the House of Representatives on the Democratic side than for the Republicans. And of course, more Americans in 7 of the last 8 presidential elections have voted for the Democratic nominee over the Republican. And when you run government based on being placed there by a minority of people, that's minority rule, it really corrupts your ability to be in a part of a representative democracy. You don't have to pay attention to what people want. You can take advantage of the structures that are biased in your favor to basically rule as you please and to lock yourself into power for as long as you please. That is a fundamental corruption, I think, of the basic ideals that the founders put in place. And it's terrifying as we move into the coming decades. I think it's going to be very... it's very concerning that one party, one major political party in America, has forsaken democracy.
Well, I want to bring you back to media just briefly, because I feel that it's, you know, even on public radio, there's such a, I don't know, obsession might not be the right word, but such a focus on so-called balance that in some cases, reporters and hosts are afraid to really call it for what it is. For fear that they might be called biased. And we're, like you just beautifully laid it out. I mean, we have so many problems to solve. And I think that's what gets me here on the show. We talk about homelessness and poverty and inequality, but these problems are so huge that the issue of minority rule, how do you think the media should really, you know, be honest about these issues in the coming months, especially as the Democrats begin to take power? Well, at least in the White House.
Yeah, this is a difficult a dilemma. I mean, we all got into this business, right? The journalists who've spent decades doing this work, with a real commitment to being fair and to being balanced. I know those are cliched terms, but they mean something to journalists. Journalists understand well that no one person gives you the full story, right? So you make sure you always check, you always give everybody a chance to comment, certainly when they're being attacked. You know, all of the 101 that we all learn as journalists, you know, those are good qualities. And those are things that have served us well over the generations. And I think the problem with what's happened in recent years is that there has been, you know, we've had this kind of transformation of the media landscape to include not just Fox News, which is an openly propagandist, you know, outfit. They have, you know, with very few exceptions on their news side, they have zero interest in actually reporting accurately. They are they have been state media for the last 4 years, and they would have happily continued to play that role through if Donald Trump had won again. Now they will be opposition media, of course. But, you know, when you have that kind of a landscape, I think it really does shift the ground under reporters' feet, and it changes the expectations, I think, that we need to have for journalists and for reporters. And I think, you know, this has been an ongoing debate, certainly over the last 4 years, about how do you respond to that and how do you adjust to it when people are exploiting your good faith in trying to achieve that balance and in trying to get the full story. How do you accurately report on that without seeming to just be a shill for one side? And that's the fear, right? That's what it looks like. It looks like reporters are now friends with the Democrats, right? That couldn't be further from the truth. I wish people could hear the conversations we have as reporters about Democrats. It's certainly, you know, we're not friends with the Democrats. I think the problem is what we are friends with is accuracy and truth and, you know, scientific accuracy. And only one side right now is also interested in that. So by reporting accurately, this was Stephen Colbert's famous line, I think it was Stephen Colbert said, you know, the truth has a liberal bias, right? You know, I don't think that that's true. But when he said that, I think he was getting at something, which is you have one political party right now, one orientation that is not interested in pursuing truth. It's interested solely in pursuing power and holding on to that power when they can get it. And we're watching it happen in real time right now. So that is going to be an ongoing struggle for journalists to accurately report on that without seeming to be in the pocket of one side or the other.
We're speaking today with Jesse Wegman, a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. One more question before we talk about your book. I mean, this is all related, but I want to bring race into this topic because you brought up what was happening in Michigan. And again, your colleagues, just a couple of hours ago, there's four of them, reported that Mayor Mike Duggan accused Trump's allies in Michigan's most populous county of racism after they threatened to block certification of the election over slight discrepancies in majority black precincts while ignoring similar problems in heavily white areas. Mayor Mike Duggan said, quote, "You could see the racism in this behavior last night. American democracy cracked, but it didn't break. But we are seeing a real threat to everything we believe in."
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just this has been the right wing playbook for several generations now. You know, we all know the guideposts along the way, from the Southern strategy of Richard Nixon through to the race baiting of both Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and up until the obvious, the most blatant racism from a major party candidate in Donald Trump that we've seen since George Wallace in 1968, who was a proud segregationist. And nearly threw the election into total chaos that year, which we can talk about. That's a story in my book. But I do think, you know, racism, you know, obviously race is one of the centerpieces, one of the central conflicts of American life right now. And it threads itself all the way back to the beginning. And I don't think anyone can really deny it. You just look at what's being said. You look at who's being targeted. We were saying this back in the summer. I had a piece back in August where I said, I guarantee you, when Donald Trump alleges fraud, when he loses, because he's going to lose and he's going to allege fraud, he is going to blame it on the urban areas, right? He's going to use this dark, insidious language. He will always use euphemisms because Donald Trump is a master of euphemism, right? But he will use it and he will say there are these uncounted ballots in bags in warehouses in the urban areas and, you know, in the inner cities, right? And we all know what that stands for. It stands for black people. It stands for brown people. And, you know, the irony of all this is that Donald Trump won more votes from black and brown people in this election, right? On the one, out of one side of their mouth, they're trumpeting the fact that Democrats like lost ground with black voters and with brown voters. And on the other side of their mouth, they're trying to, you know, call into question the legitimacy of the votes in those areas where black and brown voters voted more, right? And gave Donald Trump more votes. So it's really like, it's almost like you have to laugh. If it weren't so sad, you'd have to laugh at it. Because you know, they're actually were improving their turnout among black voters for reasons that I think are yet to be fully determined. It's a that is one of the, you know, I think for liberals particularly, it's one of the mysteries of this election. But nevertheless, it's a fact that Donald Trump did better with black and brown voters this year in 2020 than he did in 2016. And yet, nevertheless, this is their effort that they are pushing as hard as they can to say, don't count the votes in these particular areas or be suspicious of the votes and the vote count because it's black people doing it.
Right. And for listeners who haven't, there's so much happening by the hour. For listeners who didn't keep up with this, last night, Republican election board members in Wayne County, which contains Detroit, refused to certify the election results in a partisan effort to hold up Biden's victory. And according to the New York Times, Biden won 95% of the vote in Detroit, which is more than three quarters black. But right before bed on West Coast time last night, we found out that they did actually certify the election results there. There was a major outcry. And before we go to break, Jesse, we've been doing some shows for the past couple of, well, week, I guess, about the outcome of the election. Right now, I'm looking at the latest numbers. Biden is just over 79 million. Donald Trump, 73.5 million votes. And a lot of people are still asking, you know, how did Trump manage to get so many votes? What is your thinking around that?
You know, I mean, some of it is right. He got 63 million last time. So he's going to improve on that by at least 10 million, maybe up to 12 by when all the counting is done. I think there's a lot of, you know, answers to that question. And we're going to be sort of teasing them apart over the coming months and years. You know, one is obviously the power of incumbency, right? There is that quality in the American electorate and that's always been there, which is to vote for what's in place and to protect what's already there as a matter of stability and familiarity and inertia. So there's some of that going on, but obviously a 10 million, 12 million vote increase is hard to square with just that. So what else is going on? I mean, clearly turnout was goosed to record levels, right? It's the highest turnout election in over a century. By some measures, the highest turnout election, I think, in American history, given that a century ago, women weren't allowed to vote or in most places weren't allowed to vote. So you really have an astonishing turnout, even though it's still only 2/3 of the electorate, give or take, of the eligible voters. And so, you know, I think Americans have to, or liberals in particular, have to come to terms with the fact that a lot of those people really do support or did like Donald Trump. And maybe they just didn't vote in 2016. And now they were, you know, energized to come out because there was so much talk about this election. And it was such a heated election in so many ways. And then, you know, I mean, what are the other factors? You know, my colleague, Jamel Bowie, I think wrote a column today in which he, you know, he targeted those stimulus checks as being a really important part of Trump's ability to win re-election. You know, when the government sends you money, it's, you know, you're going to feel better about the government. And so, you know, I think all of these are partial explanations, and I think we need to take them seriously. And people who support democracy in general and Democrats in particular really need to think long and hard about what are the reasons that so many Americans have turned away from Democrats and in favor of a guy who's so clearly not just unfit for the job, but really an imminent threat to the functioning of democracy. I think a big part of the answer is Democrats' failure to address, you know, growing economic inequality in the country and the inability of millions of Americans, black, white, brown, of all stripes to make a decent living and to live free of the, you know, debt and free of fear of, you know, being bankrupted by a, you know, a health emergency. So I think Democrats will continue to struggle at the margins until they can figure out how to fix those problems and how to speak for a majority of Americans more robustly.
We're going to take a quick break. We're joined today by Jesse Wegman, a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Indigenous activists about this election's historic Native voter turnout. Since we are going to talk about the history of the Electoral College, it took until the 1960s and the passage of the Voting Rights Act for Native Americans to get the right to vote in every state, with Maine and Utah being among the last to recognize their full voting rights. So we'll talk about voting barriers in Indian country and find out what issues are most important to Native communities. I hope you can join us for that conversation tomorrow. Today, we're joined by Jesse Wegman, member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. If you have any questions or comments for Jesse on issues around voting, especially the Electoral College, any questions about the history of the college and what it would take to abolish it, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Jesse, let's talk about how you came to write an entire book about the Electoral College. In the acknowledgement section of your book, you write that the issue would come up when you were interviewing someone like, you know, a scholar, for example, or even just hanging out with a friend, the conversation would come up. But the tone of these conversations really became much more passionate, of course, after what happened in the 2016 election.
Right. Well, I first became interested in the topic of 20 years ago in the 2000 election. It was my, my third election in which I could vote. And I still, you know, I didn't realize, as I think most Americans didn't, quite how the Electoral College functioned, to the extent that when it did end up throwing the, White House to George W. Bush, even though Al Gore won a popular vote victory, I was shocked. I was upset. I thought, how can this be, right? And so I think much of the country felt the same way. And yet our as I talk about in the book, I think our attentions were pretty quickly diverted by September 11th and then by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that followed quickly on the heels of that day. So I think people sort of got distracted and looked elsewhere, and we sort of lost the thread on the question of how we choose the president and how undemocratic it is, small d, obviously undemocratic. And then 2016 comes along and it completely, you know, it only reinforces those concerns, because Hillary Clinton wins the popular vote by nearly six times as much as Al Gore does. This year, Joe Biden is going to win it by, I think, upwards of 10 times as much as Al Gore won by. She lost, and Joe Biden came extremely close to losing. This is something I just want to emphasize, since we're tying together our conversation about the Electoral College and my book with what happened in this past election. I think it's important for people to remember, you know, Joe Biden is winning the popular. He will win the popular vote in the end by roughly 7 million votes. Right? That is like an enormous margin in the popular vote, 7 million votes, and yet, because of, I would say we're now at between 90 and 100,000 votes scattered among three different states, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona. Those votes, without those votes, he would not be president. You flip 45,000 votes in those three states. That's nothing, right? That's smaller than the size of a college football stadium. Donald Trump would be in his second term. This was roughly the margin by which Donald Trump won the election in 2016. Remember, he won by about 77,000 votes across three states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So you have almost the mirror image in 2020 that you had in 2016. In both cases, the candidate who won a commanding victory, around the country who was clearly the choice of most Americans. And this year, an absolute majority of voters, right? He's going to end with 51%, maybe even a little more. Joe Biden will nearly lost the election. And I think that is at the heart of what for many people is the biggest insult of the college, which is that it allows this, patently anti-democratic thing to happen, which is a violation of majority rule, that the person who wins the most votes wins the election. I think that is one of the major problems with the Electoral College, and it's the one that I think most people think about when they think about its problems.
Right, and it is crazy to think that we spend so much time focusing on three, or in this case, like five or six states every presidential election.
Right. Well, that is the effect of something called the state winner take all rule. Right. And so that is what all states but two use to award their electors to the candidates. And it means exactly what it sounds like, which is whichever candidate wins the most votes in your state gets all of your electoral votes. So California, 55 electoral votes, most in the country by far. Right. You're the biggest state in the country. But you you have millions of Republican voters there. But no matter how many of them turn out for the Republican, more are going to turn out for the Democrat. We know that. We've seen it happen this year. It was on the order of millions. All of those Republican voters are erased when California casts its electoral votes, because all 55 of its electors go to the Democratic nominee, to Joe Biden. I just think that's a huge perversion of representative democracy, because you're erasing the voices of millions of people. It happens to Democrats in Texas and South Carolina. It happens to Republicans in New York and New Jersey. And that's really the ultimate problem here, is that millions of Americans rightly feel that their vote doesn't matter. The only votes that matter are the voters in these so-called battleground states. As you say, this year it was, five or six states, but it really comes down to just a handful, maybe three. Right now, we're still talking about Pennsylvania and Georgia and Arizona. Why are the voters in Pennsylvania and Georgia and Arizona any more important than the voters everywhere else in the country, or any more equipped to tell us who's going to be the president of the United States than 155 million Americans who cast ballots everywhere? That's the core argument of my book. This is the one office in the country whose occupant is tasked with representing all Americans equally wherever they live. The president is not the president of the states. The president is the president of the United States, of the people of this country, right? The Senate protects the states. The House of Representatives is there for the people, in theory, at least. The president represents everybody. So when the president is only worrying about a sliver of voters in Ohio, or a sliver of voters in Florida or Wisconsin or Arizona, that just completely contorts and distorts the whole premise of representative democracy and of representing all people equally.
And just to go over some basics, each state gets a number of electoral votes equal to its representation in Congress. So it's the number of House members and senators, right?
That's exactly right. That's why California has 53 members in the House. It has two senators. So you get 55 electoral votes.
And then small states, like, well, small Wyoming, states, for example.
Right. Right. Small states also get those two senators, right? So Wyoming is the kind of common example, because it's the smallest state in the country by population. Wyoming, every state has to get, by the Constitution's own terms, every state has to get one representative. So it doesn't matter how small you are, you get one representative. So even though California has 53 to Wyoming's one, which seems like a lot, actually the number should be closer to 80-1 if you're going to do it strictly on population. And then you have those two Senate seats, which are, every state gets those two no matter what. Those two distortions, the problem with the House not being correctly representative and the Senate being completely unrepresentative, play into the distortions of the Electoral College. And they do end up, in recent years anyway, benefiting the Republican candidate. I will say, though, and I say this because I think it comes up a lot, and it is a misunderstanding on both among people who defend the college and those who attack it, is that that effect, the effect of those Senate votes that the small states have that give them outsized sway in the Electoral College, is actually minimal. It's almost irrelevant compared to the effect of this winner-take-all rule that I'm telling you about. And it's the winner-take-all rule, and particularly the battleground states using that winner-take-all rule, that introduces the biggest distortions into our election.
I mean, when you think about what happened in Florida in 2000, that's a night I'll never forget. And I think a lot of people, especially political junkies, will never forget. I mean, as you say, Florida was essentially a tie and George W. Bush got all of those electors.
Exactly. And it goes both ways, right? Florida is like the most glaring example because it was so close when the Supreme Court ended the count. So I'm not going to say the actual margin was 537 votes, which is what it was when the Supreme Court ended the count, but because it was probably different. But let's call it 537 votes. That is essentially a tie, right? For all intents and purposes, 6 million people in Florida voted that year, separated by 537 votes. Under what theory of representative governance does it make sense for the 50% who voted for George W. Bush to get all 25 electors and for the 50% who voted for Al Gore to get zero? Republicans are experiencing that right now in, you know, to a somewhat lesser degree in states like Wisconsin, which were extremely close, right? Maybe a matter of 10,000 votes. Again, I would call that essentially a tie or very close to a tie. And yet all of Wisconsin's electors go to Joe Biden. I mean, it's just not fair. And I think people realize how unfair it is the moment that it bites them. So twice in the last 20 years, we talk about the Electoral College has benefited the Republican at the expense of the Democrat, but it can go both ways, right? In 2004, John Kerry, the Democratic nominee, would have become president with a switch of just 60,000 votes in Ohio, right? This was in an election where George W. Bush, the incumbent president, had a 3 million vote lead in the popular vote. It's the same lead that Hillary Clinton had in 2016. And yet, but for 60,000 ballots in Ohio, again, a tiny number of ballots in the bigger scheme of things, John Kerry would have been president. I think if that had happened and both parties had been burned by the Electoral College in the space of 4 years, I don't think I would have been writing this book. I think we would have been done with the Electoral College then. Yeah.
I was actually going to ask you that question. I was going to say, you know, based on your research, I just don't hear Democrats really talking about abolishing the Electoral College. But I was going to say, if things had been flipped, you could bet that the Republicans would be working night and day to get rid of this thing.
Well, and they have been. That's what's interesting is that Republicans see just as well how bad the Electoral College is under the state winner take all rule. And that's the foundation for this effort, which if you want, I can explain this National Popular Vote Compact, which originated not far from where you are. A man named John Koza, who's a computer scientist in the Bay Area, actually came up with this about 15 years ago. And it is a way of using the state power to award their electoral votes differently than states do today. So the way this works is, remember I was saying that the state winner-take-all rule is at the heart of the problem. The state winner-take-all rule is not constitutional. I don't mean it's unconstitutional. I mean it is not in the Constitution. There is no requirement that states use this or any other specific rule to award their electors. This is purely a decision made by your state lawmakers, my state lawmakers all over the country. They have all chosen winner-take-all throughout most of American history because it gives the dominant party in a state a lot of political clout to be able to say to their candidate, we're going to deliver you all of our electors. But I explained already the problem, the distortion that's caused by that way of allocating electors. So what this compact does, it's called an interstate compact, and that's just an agreement among states to work together to do something under the terms of a what is effectively a contract. And states that join this compact agree to award their electoral votes not to the winner of their statewide vote, but to the candidate who wins the most votes in all 50 states combined, plus Washington, D.C. When states representing a majority of electoral votes in the country, 270 is a majority, that's what you need to become president. When states representing that number join this compact, it takes effect by its own terms. It kicks into gear and automatically the candidate who wins the most votes in the country becomes the president. So it's actually a really, I think, ingenious and fairly simple and clear way to use the Electoral College as it is designed in the Constitution to achieve a national popular vote, as opposed to doing so by amendment, which, as you said at the top of the show, has been tried close to 800 times without real success. So it's a really interesting strategy, and it's been gaining support for the last 15 years. There's 15 states that have now joined it, along with DC, and they represent 196 electoral votes. So remember I said you need 270. That means they're 74 electoral votes away from this taking effect and from America electing its president by the national popular vote.
Now, those 15 states have solid Democratic leadership. Colorado is the first state that has embraced this. They're a swing state. And this is really interesting because Colorado voters just passed Proposition 113, which confirms lawmakers' decision to assign the state's Electoral College votes to the candidate who wins the national popular vote. So Colorado is now a part of this compact.
That's right. And Colorado, you know, I think it's Colorado is really no longer a swing state, or it's a swing state the way Ohio is a swing state, right? Mm-hmm. It's a fundamentally, the Democrats are pretty comfortably winning that state now, just as Republicans are pretty comfortably winning Ohio. But Colorado was very recently what we would call a purple state. And so it was a big deal that they passed it because, as you say, all the other states to date had been states with solid Democratic leadership. But here's what I'll say about that. I actually think when you talk to the people who run the compact, there are Republicans and Democrats together. They've been working together for years. They go and make their case to lawmakers in states around the country. The Republican members go and talk to Republican lawmakers, and Democratic members go talk to Democratic lawmakers. And that's because it takes different arguments. Democrats are, for obvious reasons, much more eager to reform the system, and Republicans are much less eager. So it takes a subtle approach, and it takes different types of argumentation. And in fact, before the 2016 election, there was a lot of Republican interest in this compact. There were more than 150 co-sponsors who were Republican lawmakers around the country of bills in their state legislatures to pass this compact. Obviously, after the 2016 election happened and you had the split between the popular vote and the Electoral College, again, benefiting the Republican lawmakers ran for the hills. You know, they did not want to be associated with anything that looked like it might, work to the detriment of Republican candidates. But I really think it goes to show you that when people see how the Electoral College doesn't help them or could hurt them in the very near future, they are much more open to reform opportunities. And I really do think, you know, the example that I've been using recently, because I think it's pretty compelling, is the example of Texas. Texas has been a solid Republican state for decades now, right? And it is the second biggest prize in the country after California. It has 38 electoral votes. Republicans count on those 38 electoral votes to get to the White House. But Texas is very quickly shifting demographically and politically. It could very well, you know, we were talking about would Texas turn blue, would the Democrats win Texas this year? It didn't happen. And I think it was clear that it wasn't going to happen. But the fact that we were even talking about it and that it very well could happen in 2024 or 2028 should terrify Republicans who are defending the Electoral College. Because without Texas, Republicans have no path to the White House through the Electoral College.
Right. And a lot of activists on the ground say that, you know, they're doing the hard work of making sure that more people vote in Texas, and the demographics are changing, the population is changing. So do you think the only way to abolish the Electoral College at this point is to ensure that more states embrace this compact?
It's certainly the furthest along effort, right? In my book, I talk about the effort that got closest of any in American history, which happened in the late 1960s. And that was an effort to actually amend the Electoral College completely out of the Constitution and replace it with a popular vote. That got astonishingly close, like painfully, heartbreakingly close, and failed in the Senate thanks to a filibuster, not by the small states, which is what most people think, right? When they say, oh, the Electoral College protects the small states. It's not true. It hurts the small states. It was a filibuster led by Southern segregationist senators who, you know, were basically just repeating what had happened throughout American history, especially in the South. These were the descendants of slaveholders themselves. They knew how the Electoral College under the winner-take-all rule benefited them and hurt their Black citizens. And so they were going to protect it at all costs. I think that effort failed. And I think we are only a more polarized country, both racially and in partisan terms than we were in the late 1960s. So I think that's probably not a path that's going to be achieved anytime soon. The compact is definitely the closest that we've gotten since then. I'm cautiously optimistic. It certainly faces, it will face legal and constitutional challenges if it is to take effect. But I think the exercise itself is really valuable because it's showing Americans just how inequitable and unfair the Electoral College is under the state winner-take-all rule as it now functions. And it's making people realize there are other ways we can do this. There are ways we can be fairer to all Americans everywhere. And I think the more we can have that conversation out in the open, the better.
And we have about 7 or so minutes left. Since you talked, and I'm so glad you brought up what happened in the 60s and 70s when Senator Birch Bayh, a Democrat from Indiana, wanted to replace the Electoral College. You write that the racial element really carries all the way through U.S. history, of course. And the Electoral College really began in a negotiation that protected the interests of slaveholding states. Can you just explain that? I hate to ask you to do it quickly, but I have just a couple more questions
yeah, sure.
before we end.
Nope. I'll do it as quick as I can. I mean, the protection of the slaveholding states and their interest was at the heart of every major deal that was struck at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. This isn't a secret. This is this is basic American history. The founders themselves were saying this at the convention. And what ended up happening was that, you know, they adopted this system that we now call the Electoral College, in part because they would not go for a popular vote. James Madison himself, the father of the Constitution, says this at the convention. He says a popular vote for president would be better, but the slave states won't go for it. He says on the score of the Negroes. That's his term. Mm-hmm. And what he means is when, you know, a state, has to do a popular vote and can't include half of its population that it has enslaved and hasn't given the right to vote, it's not going to have much influence in the outcome of the election. So they end up, you know, the Electoral College is adopted for multiple reasons, but one of them is because slave states are going to benefit from it because they get extra electoral votes for their slaves. And that is through what we know as the Three-Fifths Clause. That was the clause that was adopted at the convention to give slave states extra representation in Congress for their slaves, even though those slaves couldn't vote. When you transfer that into the Electoral College as it's designed, right, you get your electors based on your representation in Congress. That means you also get extra power in choosing the president. That power carried all the way through the Civil War and even after. So slavery and its descendants and the racial subjugation and racial discrimination throughout American history are intricately intertwined with the way we've chosen our president from the start.
And here we are today. Studies have shown that white voters have far more power than voters of color because of the Electoral College.
Well, it happens today that swing states, the states that happen to be swing states are whiter and older than the average American state. So there actually aren't any more. They're actually less representative of America than other states. Yes, it continues to work to the detriment of Black voters everywhere, many of whom are clustered in cities where their votes are systematically devalued because of this state winner-take-all rule.
We have several emails from listeners who say, what about the argument that candidates would focus only on large states if we abolish the Electoral College? What would happen to the smaller states?
Well, I mean, that has a sort of the premise of that question is, first of all, I sort of take issue with the premise of the question, which is that states as states have unique, wills or feelings. States are made up of people who have lots of different motivations and who care about lots of different things. So as you talked about earlier, California has millions of Republicans. It has rural areas. It has urban areas, right? California is not a static place that either is a Democratic state or a Republican state. And so I really think that candidates who are faced with having to win votes everywhere and having to win the most votes to become president would in fact approach the election by going everywhere to win those votes. They would not just sit in the big cities or the big states. They couldn't come close to getting enough votes in those places to win a national election. Those cities, those big cities that I think people often talk about when they ask that question, which is usually when I hear it, it's New York, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, whatever they want to say. Those states don't have close to enough people to influence the outcome of an election. But regardless, when you look at how candidates actually run in elections where the most votes wins the election and all votes count equally. Let's use a governor's race for an example. They go everywhere. They go to all parts of the state. They don't just sit and, you know, vacuum up votes in the big cities. If they're a Democrat, they go all over the state because they know even if they're not going to win a portion of the state, they want to lose the portion by less. And it's all about those margins, right? And so I just think it's this is campaigning 101. I'm not revealing anything, magical here. This is how campaigns work. When you need to win the most votes to win and all votes count equally, you are going to go everywhere to win those votes.
Hmm. And final thoughts, Jesse, we've got about a minute or so left. What's next on this push to get states to embrace this interstate compact? Do you think that we'll see even more states embrace this before the 2024 election?
You know, every advance in American history when it comes to electoral politics and representative government has been in the direction of more inclusion, more people being enfranchised, more people counting, and greater equality. And I think that's really the heart of the story here, is that America has been on this 230-year arc of democratization from a country that was founded, you know, on slavery and on the and disenfranchisement of women and of Native Americans, now, you know, expanding to include virtually all eligible people over the age of 18 are eligible to vote for the president. I think when you have a system like that, it is a true modern representative democracy. You can't continue to operate it on the assumptions that were in place 200 plus years ago. And I think the more people realize that and the more people see how the Electoral College could hurt them going forward, I think you are going to have the necessary momentum and the necessary consensus for a change in how we choose the president.
Jesse Wegman is a member of the New York Times editorial board. I hope you can check out his latest op-ed called The Republican Party is Attacking Democracy. You can find that and other pieces at yourcallradio.org. Jesse is author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Jesse, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And coming up tomorrow, we will speak with indigenous activists about this election's historic Native voter turnout. Joe Biden's win in Arizona and New Mexico was made possible by 60 to 90% of voters in the Navajo Nation, which at one point had the highest COVID infection rate in the country. We will talk about voting barriers in Indian country and find out what issues are most important to Native communities. I hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. You can find out more about the show and listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.